Big news here at the Blanket Fort. We have got our first official sponsor. Drop the banners, play the fanfare. We have arrived. People Pleaser is officially brought to you by Marmalade Music. Now, I want you to pay close attention to the audio quality of this episode and every episode going forward, because as I'm sure you're well aware, I was struggling to find consistency on episodes 1 through 10 with the sound. I did my best, and I don't think they were unlistenable or anything like that, but I'm aware that there was a lot of room for improvement to take this show to the next level. Some episodes were way too quiet with only certain parts that would randomly spike in volume. There was a lot of background noise, and I tried my best to avoid this, but I could only do so much. And this is mainly because, to put it simply, I'm not a trained audio engineer. I know enough to mix and edit the episodes, and honestly, I probably know more than most who want to start a podcast or record an album of original music from home. But I don't know squat about compressing, maximizing, and mastering to get a clean, professional-sounding product that maintains consistent volume across the episode and comes through nice and clear. And if you're like me, a musician or a podcaster or both doing homemade audio projects, you probably run into your fair share of frustrating roadblocks. Now, you could study audio engineering for 2 to 3 years and learn all there is to know and just do it on your own, or you could hire someone who already has all that expertise and get to work producing top quality content right away. I'm using Marmalade right now for mixing and mastering on everything I do, and it's saving me time and producing better quality content than I've ever been able to achieve on my own. Seriously, go back and listen to any episode 1 through 10 and then compare it to this one, and you will notice the difference. It may be subtle to the untrained ear, but in an age where everyone has access to top-of-the-line equipment, the devil is in the details, and your project deserves to have those details in tip-top shape. And Marmalade doesn't just do mixing and mastering. They have packages for whatever your project requires. They even offer recording and producing services, so if you're looking to up your audio game, contact Marmalade Music today by visiting marmalademusicslc.com to get a quote. And mention this podcast to take 20% off your first project. That's marmalademusicslc.com. Mention People Pleaser for 20% off. We are 20 years into the 21st century. 20 years from Y2K, from the first Matrix movie, from a time when Will Smith was still rapping. And 20 years into the coming of age of the generation we've all agreed to name, the Millennials. But as a famous playwright whose name escapes me once said, what's in a name? What indeed? And why do we feel the need to put a name to something as seemingly arbitrary as a generation? Generally, Millennial is the term used to refer to people born between 1980 and the year 2000, obviously deriving from the millennium at the turning of the 21st century. But how do we, as a society, come to these agreements? Who makes the cutoff? Why is the cutoff 1980 and not 1979 or 78? If you were 22 when 99 turned to 2000, you were far too grown to understand the millennial experience. But if you were a babyface 20, then you made the cut? According to whom? And what does it even mean? I was 12 in the year 2000. I feel like I had way less in common with someone born in 78 than someone born in 80 would have at the time. Obviously, people who were alive for certain events have shared experiences that can serve in a very general way to help categorize them in the scope of all human history. But did a person born in 1973 really have that much of a different viewpoint on September 11, 2001 than a person born in 1983? I mean, hard to say, but probably not, right? Or at least, if they did, it was probably due to a whole slew of other factors that had nothing to do with their dates of birth. My point is, I think I get why we feel inclined to name generations in order to simplify and categorize historical narratives, but I'm wondering if, in the present, it's actually useful. Should I feel particularly bonded to my fellow millennials any more than I feel bonded to my baby boomer parents? Do we have a specific purpose, calling, or historical responsibility as a particular generation, or are we just another batch of humans, more or less indistinguishable from any other that came before or that will come after? Is there really that big of a difference between Gen Z and Gen Y? Or is it all just perception? If you've been listening to the show so far, then you can make an educated bet that my guest and I will come nowhere close to answering any of these questions. But we'll have a good bit of fun exploring them anyway. Today on the show, I've got one of my favorite people. From the moment I first met this guy as a young, scared college freshman, I knew he came from good stock. He bought me a chicken sandwich one night when I was at the school late hanging lights for a production of Macbeth by that playwright whose name I can never seem to recall. He did it without even being asked to. He could just see that I was tired and hungry, so he surprised me with a gift. And we'd barely spoken five words to each other before that. He's become a great friend, a fantastic intellectual sparring partner, and a big inspiration. I'm glad he wanted to come talk a bit about what he sees as the calling our generation needs to answer. You'll hear me try my damnedest to douse his optimism, but if you know Carlton, you'll know it's near impossible to ever get him to stop seeing the bright side. So, from a Blanket Fort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to my very good friend Carlton Bluford about millennials.
You remember when we were in college and we would make blanket forts and play Halo 3 till like 3 a.m.?
Yes, actually.
I think we did that before we ever saw an episode of Community too. Like we,
Yeah.
So like watching that show, it was just like, we did that.
Yeah.
In college.
100%.
We didn't go to a community college, but
no,
close to it.
God, that was crazy.
Yeah, that was
really fun back in the day.
Yeah. We'd stay up and play, like we'd be on Xbox Live and we would stay up sometimes till 5 or 6 a.m. in the morning and just be like, uh-oh, I have class in 2 hours,
yeah.
But I'm so busy poning noobs yeah. with my energy sword.
Wow, yeah.
Getting shotguns and like jumping and going, kapoo, you know, like you shoot
and then you hit him
with the hilt of your shotgun.
Yeah.
And that's like I love that move. That and energy swords. Or like the Warhammer, like the big hammer.
I never got good at that, but yeah, vibrating.
You'd hit it
hammer.
And it would like knock them back like 5,000 feet. They'd go like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, yeah, blow people off of cliffs and stuff.
That's how I got my name though. My nickname was a surgeon because I was a surgeon with a shotgun.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's like not everyone could get the technique with the shotgun.
Yeah.
It seems like you would be automatically good at it, but that was a thing. You had to be surgical.
Absolutely.
You had to know when to shoot and when to hit B so that the hilt comes up at the right time when you land, so it's like shot you, hit you in the face, you know.
yeah absolutely. 100%.
Uh-huh. Cool. Well, glad you came over. This is great having you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
It's Carlton really nice.
Bluford. Kid Blue himself. That sounds like I said Kid Blue himself.
Not to be confused, because that's another guy. It's not me.
That's another guy named Kid who had a couple ribs removed and st- starting over.
Abort, abort.
I'll just edit all of that out. Millennials. I think it's interesting that you brought this up to talk about. That's not something that I thought of. I have like a long list of things that I would like think of asking people to come on and talk about. And being a millennial is not something I had thought of. I think it's such an interesting, like, as I've been thinking about it, I'm like, is it even useful to categorize people in this way? You know, like, is it useful to say, like, to have these terms, boomer and Gen X? And I don't know. It feels like it's also like the balance is off. Like it feels like there's like boomer, which I think is what, 50s, 60s. If you're born in the 50s and 60s, like and there was like the greatest generation, the generation that like dealt with the depression and came out of it and won World War II, and the greatest generation. And I mean, to be fair, like they dealt with a good amount of strife and adversity.
Oh yeah, of course.
I don't think it's any crazier than like going through the Civil War or like anything like that, or the Revolutionary War for that matter, or any of the insane shit of, you know, like stealing land from indigenous people. But sure, they're the greatest. Go ahead and just call yourselves, like, who gave them that moniker too? Like, well, this is the greatest generation, then there's boomers, and then like it feels like all the way from boomers, you don't get another name until Gen X, right? Is there another thing in between?
I'm not exactly sure.
Is right? There like disco cocaine babies? Like,
like the I'm not sure what it's called, but there's definitely a switch where that happened. You had these really, which felt like at the time, uptight, you know, social whatever, to the point where people were like, yeah, I'm not doing that anymore. And the pendulum swung the other way, right?
Yeah.
So, but you can't, you know, I feel like the great generation had all these rules of how things should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then we transitioned into, well, I don't like rules, so I'm not doing anything. And then I think we learned, well, you can't not have like this base of rules. You can't not have that.
Oh, you need to at least have some.
You need to have some kind of structure.
Uh-huh.
But then you also can't just do whatever you want all the time, right?
Yeah.
They have to find a middle ground. I think that's kind of where we landed, right?
Yeah.
We're trying to find this middle ground.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, maybe feeling like a middle child is kind of every labeled generation's thing, where like right now we feel like we're in between Gen X and Gen Z. And like, I didn't know this too. I thought Gen Y was a different thing. Did you know that Gen Y is just another term for millennials?
No, I did not know that actually.
I guess it makes sense. I thought it was like Gen X, millennial, Gen Y, Gen Z.
Yeah.
But apparently, I mean, I was trying to look up concrete definitions of what is a millennial, because I also see people talking about this online. They're like, I don't know if I qualify,
right?
Or if I made the cut. And it looks like it's pretty broad. I mean, not as broad as what we seem to be applying the term boomer to. We seem to be applying that to like a 30-year span of birth dates. But it's like mid to late 80s on through the 90s. And the definition that I saw, like the concrete definition, was like a term for someone who came of young adulthood in the early 21st century, which again, I'm like,
wow, okay.
Well, what are we talking about as early 21st century? Because it still feels like it's the early 21st century, right?
Yeah.
I know we're 20 years in, but in 100 years, this will still be considered, you know, like 1920, yeah. I would consider that the early 20th century, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, actually. I mean, yeah, I think these definitions come from, right? These movements are in huge, impactful moments or trends. I mean, whether it be in fashion, whether it be in politics, or whether it be in whatever, I think that those are monikers or what I would say markers of these transitions into different time periods, into different whatever. Because I, for the longest time, thought that my brother, Generation X, and I was like, well, I'm Generation X too. Like, that's what I am. And I like kind of identified with that. You know what I mean?
Gen X is cool, dude.
Gen X is cool.
Gen X is way cool.
Yeah.
Kurt Cobain and shit. Like flannel shirts. Also, like Gen X was like, I got to learn to stop drinking water and swallowing. First of all, like you were talking and I was like, I've heard on the show before me just going. And I'm like, every time I do it, I'm like, damn it. I need to remember to like back up and not I have my slurping slug of water going down my throat for everyone.
People are okay with you, you know, drinking water on the show.
Disrespectful. Everyone's all right, right? Everyone's chill.
Yeah, they're cool.
Cool. No, but Gen X is interesting. I mean, you can really see, and maybe we do this in pop culture, we really clearly define, but you can really see like these stylistic differences between, I think it's harder to see 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. They all sort of blend together for me. Like there are distinct differences. If you asked a costume designer, they'd be like, no, the lapels on suits were clearly distinctive. But it was like guys were wearing suits and women were wearing dresses and like, you know, but then like 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you see these distinct style differences, these distinct movements and identity and style. And the 90s, though, was the first one where it felt, and maybe it's because of where I was born, but it felt truly modern. It felt truly like, this is now, don't give a fuck. Just wearing like baggy t-shirt with like baggy jeans or with like, everything just became so radically different and so radically kind of self-actualized in this new way of like, this is what it is now. And it felt like the beginning of the arrival of the future, you know?
I agree 100%, which is actually the interesting thing about this. As you were talking, you know, I realized that during that time, we were being fed certain things, like we were being fed our morals. Like we were watching these TV shows, we were watching these cartoons that were basically saying, you know, hey, this is the way an upstanding citizen should be. And these are the superheroes that do that. And you should be like that. And if you fail, it's okay. Just get back up again and try all these morals and all these morals, which we were raised on. But then as we start to grow up, we later see the adults who are teaching us these morals falter, right? We start to see them following.
Paradise Lost.
Paradise Lost. And so I think that's when in the 90s, for me at least, I was like, well, what am I doing? What do I believe? And I keep hearing this over and over again in my head. The slogan for us when we were kids was, stop playing video games, do something with your life. What are you doing? You're never going to amount to anything. All these things, right?
Were we the first generation to be told by our adults, like, stop playing video games?
Ooh.
Or did that begin with Pong and arcades in the 80s?
But that was, then, I mean.
But when did home video gaming become? I think it was like with the Sega Genesis and with like the Super Nintendo and the NES was like 89. Something like that. So I think, maybe like that we were the first to really have, you know, sophisticated in-home systems.
Entertainment systems. Which were, you know, I mean, I can defend being a kid and playing video games, you know, all for who knows how long. I mean, people were creating intricate stories. People were creating immersive stories that I felt like I could be in and I could explore my own, you know, decision-making in this small little world.
Like going on a saga through Final Fantasy.
Exactly.
And being like, I lived in that place.
Right.
And even with that, the crude original graphics, you know.
Mm-hmm. And there was a level of escapism there that I think that adults didn't realize that I was actually developing my own opinion about life. And so I think that this is, I don't know if we can go here now, but this is where we are now. I feel like we have a generation of people who have all of this knowledge at their fingertips and all this technology at their fingertips. But are kind of waiting, I guess, to become that superhero. That's what I think.
You think that we still think that that's like in the cards? That's like in the like we're not completely jaded on
honest with you, because you see it. You see this.
Yeah.
I think that the jadedness is is the kid in us, right? Being like, nah, we've seen all this. Screw you guys. We don't trust you. But underneath all those layers, there's this kernel, this little kernel of hope that's been taught in us. Like, because at some point, right, at the end of the game, at the last second, something's going to happen. Someone's going to come and triumphantly take all of this and make it better again. I just don't think that we realize that someone is us.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. If I ask myself, I still think that. That's the reason why I do anything.
Right.
I just, like, still keep figuring, like, It's gonna turn around.
You know
it's
what I mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And what's popular? You think of what's popular. I mean, sorry, but we had this huge generation of superhero movies. Why do we keep going to see superhero movies? Why? Something's gonna come out soon and I'm gonna go
see it. Cool?
Yeah, they're cool. But the good guy comes back and sometimes they lose, but they always come back to fight and win. Always. Star Wars. There's how many Jedi's are there's gonna be one Jedi out there under a rock somewhere.
Well, that was the coolest thing. Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, of course, yeah. Like, if they just did 7, 8, and 9, it's like, no, the Jedi are dead. Like, yeah. But there's these new people and they can shoot. Like, it's just like, so wait, there's Siths on the other side? Oh, yeah, there's Siths. There's so many.
Plenty
Siths.
Of them.
But it's like, yeah, I mean, the coolest, I remember seeing the movie Infinity War in the theater and being like, yes. That's the coolest ending I've ever seen, just because I really didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
I really was watching the movie. I was having a good time. I was laughing. I was thinking like, oh, this is they did a good job with this movie.
Yep.
But I really was like, and here it comes. Thor swoops in and he hits him in the chest with the axe. And sorry if you haven't seen this movie. How have you not seen this movie?
But, yeah.
Like, if you haven't, imagine you don't care and like, you won't go see it. But yeah, Thor swoops in. He hits him like, ah, yeah, here he comes. And then when they lost, I was like, oh my. And it's like, of course. Of course there's another movie and of course they're going to win, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But what a great ending. What a, you know, to just everyone dies and the end shot is the villain looking out over the spoils of his victory and just kind of like, yeah, I did it. You know, I mean, the balls, and, you know, but
that's where we are now. I think that talking about what you were saying, we're so used to losing. We're so used to failing and we're so used to being told we're going to lose and fail. And so I think that ending was like, oh, it was like surprising. But at the same time, I think it came at the most poignant time because it was like, yep, well, that's real life. I remember having a conversation about Game of Thrones and I don't watch it. And people are like, why don't you watch Game of Thrones? It's so real. It's so real life. That's what happens. Sometimes in life you get raped, you know, sometimes in life you get your throat slit, you know? And it's like, yes. Okay. Like being realistic, life, it doesn't always happen, you know, in happy endings, but the majority of it should, right? I mean, aren't we all just holding out for that happy ending? None of us want to just live a horrible, horrible life and at the end you have your throat slit. That
I wrote
sucks.
An essay of like 5 years ago when I was first watching Game of Thrones that was along the lines of that, and I'd never published it, posted it anywhere. But like I wrote this thing about like the reason why the show's so good is there are no good guys and no bad guys. Like there's no one who's clearly the protagonist and clearly immune from you know, danger. Like everyone is just playing in the same rules of this universe. And that's that realistic thing of like, everyone's the hero in their own story. Everyone thinks that there's no way they can't fail because they're destined to be successful.
Yeah.
And it even feels like that sometimes when you're following some of these storylines, like this person's going to be protected. I'm going to be with this person for a while. And that show would undercut that constantly.
Yeah.
And I think that's what disappointed a lot of people about the final season of that show is that it became the kind of show where characters were wearing significant plot armor and where main characters did seem to be impervious to any and all threats. And it sort of became like, oh, well, this isn't what I initially started watching this show for. But that it is that interesting that we all still sort of buy into this thing of us being the heroes of our own story, like you and I are impervious to being hit by a bus today when we are crossing the street. Like, no, I've got more to do.
Yeah.
And I've sort of lived on that idea my whole life, is like this sort of being pulled by destiny through my life. And I acknowledge the possibility that a plane I'm on could crash, but also like, there's always this thing of like, not me. That's not how I go.
Right.
That's not how my story ends. I have more triumph, you know?
Yeah.
But isn't it true that life doesn't work that way?
You know, I think that that's the point, right? I think that we get to try to decide, and I don't think we have. So we were talking about the 1950s and 1960s. They decided that, nope, this is how it goes, right? We win the war. Bottom line, We build an excellent war machine. Everyone supports us. Everyone at home is doing their duties as the women and the men. And we go to war and we win.
See, but the 60s, that was their attitude. And what changed that, I think, is the war came into everyone's televisions and everyone's homes. And that in part with other things that were shifting in the political landscape. But our attitude going into Vietnam was, this is what we do. We go in and we win. That war was a shit disaster. Show. Yes. Because you had all these things happening that are happening exponentially in our childhood, where it's like, it's in your living room. Yeah. You turn on the TV and you weren't watching World War II on TV. You could go to the movie theater and like see those little clip shows they'd put together, like propaganda films and things. But there were journalists just, you know, going through camps. And I don't think that there was the brutality of the war on TV.
No.
And we still get shielded from a lot of that, even when but you can look up some pretty grisly stuff online these days. And I think that in the 60s is the beginning of you start having, you know, massive protests around the idea of going to war. And that's, again, like I was saying, there's this sort of wash of 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s to me in my brain, the greatest generation. The 60s are where you start to see, and again, these are the boomers, these are the children of the greatest generation. We start seeing this really profound change in identity, where people are really asserting the ideas of peace and the civil rights movement is happening and all this stuff. And war doesn't really fit into that. Being like a world dominator doesn't really fit into that.
Yeah.
And the old roles and the old rules aren't really fitting. I feel like that gives birth to the Rolling Stone that goes on to create Gen X and by association us. What's interesting about us to me is that hinge point. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That we're a hinge generation, and that like rather than things progressing from the ball that started in the 60s with the flower generation, I guess that's what we call them. I don't know. The boomers. We'll just say boomers. It all seemed to take a severe turn with the internet and with the massive upscale and technological advancement that happened right in the period that we were coming to young adulthood.
Yes. Wow. Very eloquently put. No. I have to say two things really quick about this. Right. One, there's something very significant that happens. World War II, very clear enemy who's going to kill everyone and destroy everything, has to be stopped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to go in. We have to be heroes. We go in, a lot of great people die, and we do it, right?
But isn't it easier to paint a clearer narrative with less available information to the masses?
Oh, of course.
You can paint a much clearer, like, hey, here's the situation. We were sideswiped by the Japanese, and we were, and these people are trying to take over the world, and they're all bad guys, and we're the good guys. Like, isn't it easier to distribute that?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Versus Vietnam, right? Many people were like, why are we there? What are we doing there? Are we actually helping? Including some of the soldiers. And the treatment of the two soldiers, right, coming home from war, vastly different, right? Because is this a moral war or is it not? I think that translates.
That's one of the craziest things to me is the way that, like, Vietnam soldiers got blamed.
Right.
For the shit that people were like, ah, fuck you, you baby killer. Like, it's like, hey, we had a draft.
We didn't even choose to go.
These are victims that are coming home. These are like young boys that were thrust into hell. And I mean, that's insane the way that we responded.
But that's what you're talking about, this age of bringing things into the television. So I had someone ask me the other day about these things that are happening with Trump and impeachment, yada, yada. And someone was like, you know, it just seems like, you know, millennials don't even care. And I was thinking about that, and I was like, you know what? I don't think they do. And you know what? I'm not sure they should. I don't know that I have to preface this because that's a bold statement, but I truly believe that the things millennials are worrying about on the day-to-day are things that I have to say this very carefully, right? I just stepped into a political realm. I'm like, uh-oh, what are you talking? What are you going to say? What are you going to say?
It's all right. Speculate.
I think.
Just fucking fly off the handle.
Let me just say it from my perspective so I don't say anything about one group of people or not. As soon as I felt that when the Twin Towers happened, mm-hmm. as soon as I felt for a second that that might have been a setup on our end in any way, shape, or form, whether it was or not, mm-hmm. I started to doubt what
everything
is happening on that level. Everything,
the whole system.
Everything, right?
Yeah.
So fast forwarding to now, do I care about what's happening? Yes, of course. I care what's happening with policy and who gets elected and yada, yada. However, the way that we've been going about it for the last who knows how many years, I feel is completely broken, completely. And you're seeing it in the youth. It's not reaching the youth. And they're like, why can't we get the youth vote? Because
they're not buying it.
They're not buying your bullshit mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah. But all of that to me seems to come back to distribution of information, like the information era and the impact that it had. And that hinge that I was that impact seems to be like an atomic blast of just,
yeah,
that you can't, it's a before and after moment for sure. But you know, like I've seen a tweet that was like, you know, it was like, boomers, what's wrong with millennials? And then millennials, oh, I don't know. We watched 3,000 people die on national television when we were little kids and things never got better. So,
yeah,
you know, and it's kind of like, I wonder about our traumas. I even had a question written down about like millennial trauma, like seeing 9/11 on TV. And were our traumas any more intense or worse than any other generation's trauma? I mean, think about the trauma of like witnessing the crash of the stock market in 1929 witnessing like the vast change of the socioeconomical landscape where everyone was like thriving and, you know, the Prohibition era and jazz clubs and speakeasies and going to, you know, Hoovervilles and things like that. Like every generation has their traumas, but was our trauma because of the information age so much more severe? You know, our ability to talk to each other through that, maybe it wasn't as, you know, severe to shut us up, but maybe it just got us talking more. I don't know. Or watching the assassination of JFK, or, you know, I mean, I don't think that his assassination was on TV. It wasn't. But the Zapruder film got released at some point and people saw that, but definitely Lee Harvey Oswald was shot on TV. You know, there's some crazy stuff that people were being shown in their living rooms. And I don't know. I don't know if it's a, if we're more inclined in our generation, probably, because I really do think that the disbursement of the information and our ability to talk to each other through it is so exponentially bigger. But I don't know if like what we saw was crazier or worse, you know?
I you know, Austin, I honestly think that every generation dating back to who knows how long has dealt with a certain amount of trauma happening around them mm-hmm. as the United States is formed. And God, I mean, there's so much trauma just because of the things that happen externally. However, I think that, you know, and I could be wrong, I'm not a psychiatrist, but if a psychiatrist, you know, was looking back at different time periods, different people, they could say something like, oh, well, the trauma of this person born in this time was because their parents in the 50s thought a certain way and taught them a certain way that didn't fit them, or put them in a certain box that didn't fit them, or whatever, mm-hmm. right? And that can, and that trend continues on. I think the hinge you're talking about, this information boom, I think this place that we're in, our parents started teaching us a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. On based off of whenever they were born, 50s, 60s, 70s. And then everything changed so drastically quickly mm-hmm. that some of the things that they were teaching us ended up changing into something else. So they're like, okay, I guess we'll teach you this now. And then now we're like, well, I don't know what to teach you, nor do I understand how you feel about any of it, right? And we're doing things like putting ourselves on YouTube or putting ourselves out there, expressing ourselves in really weird ways, really crazy ways. I think trying to figure out what the hell our identity and how we actually feel about all these things actually, you know.
And I think I do think that there's an element of every generation dealing with that, dealing with the generation before kind of muddling their way through trying to educate them, but there's new rules and they're trying to like catch up and like learn the new rules and learn like the new, I think that happens a lot. with technological advancements, you know, like like when cars were invented, people who their entire livelihood was based on horse and buggies, like had to teach their kids like, this is a car. I think it works. A combustion engine is
you have to turn the thing in the front, and if you do that, it'll go.
It goes where you it doesn't have horses. You know, like there's always been this stuff, and there's always been generations who kind of come to early adulthood in those technological hinges and shifts. And it feels so like myopic and self-centered, but it also feels evidentially true that our hinge was different.
It's like, very different.
And Gen Z gets a little bit of this. Gen Z still has a generation of parents that are millennials themselves and who are still trying to like grapple with like, what's it like to raise a kid who's born with a tablet in their hands?
Yeah.
And who's, you know, and raising children who there's no shielding them from the technology and from the smart devices and things like that. They are augmented humans. They are the first generation of augmented people who are born with their technology being fused to, you know, it's like, this is happening and we need to reckon with that. So Gen Z gets a little bit of that, but at least they get parents who are going to be starting from a reasonable place. You know, we went through such a massive shift that almost everything we were being raised on became completely
obsolete. Yeah.
By the time we were in our late teens, early 20s. And even so much so that it was happening when we were in college.
Yeah.
And the education system wasn't teaching it.
No, exactly.
Because they were still, they were not catching up, but it was like, it was happening. Like you said, we had cell phones and stuff. I didn't have I think I got my first iPhone when I was like 22 or 23, right after I finished college.
Okay.
But I know people had them. I know that the iPhones were invented in 2007. My freshman year was 2006, 2007. So I know that like it was happening and I know that like tablets and things like that were coming out.
Yeah.
But we weren't immediately shifting the curriculum to here's what it's going to look like. Here's how you upload a self tape. Here's how you start a YouTube page. And like, here's how you self create content and self generate in show business. We were still being taught the old format.
Yep.
And and that's nobody's fault. That's just, I don't think anyone could have accounted for how massive the shift was.
Right.
Right. When we were coming into it.
I mean, I think that leads into what I was going to say about being a millennial and millennials. I mean, I guess I'm a millennial, but at the same time, there's a gap there where I'm old and I'm not old, but I feel like our part of the generation was skipped. And when I say that, I'm working with this, this young millennial now who's 24, I think 23, 24. And we're
potentially even qualify for Gen Z.
But I mean, yeah,
it's going to be 2020. So yeah, technically late 90s, if they were born 96, then, you know, they make it. They make the cut.
Oh, they make the cut. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Well,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she's, you know, we're talking about Microsoft Outlook and she's like, why did you do this? And I'm like, oh, I just figured. She's like, no, it's just easier. Here's the shortcut to this and blah, blah, blah. And that makes it easier for you. And almost in a way of like, why didn't you know this? You know? And I'm like, huh? Why didn't I? I mean, the information I feel like came so quickly that it just like passed me by. And I feel like still that I'm catching up. And so it's like, what can my part of the generation offer to the future? I feel like the only thing I can offer is those. It's like the whole Mr. Miyagi and Karate Kid thing. They're going to take off and they're going to be ruling things and they're going to lead it. Right. I just feel like they need someone to be like, okay, young grasshopper, like, this is how this goes, or this is how this can go, you know, like because we know those, I feel like those group of morals that work, or we know those, at least the, I don't know, the pep talks or the, don't you forget about me. Like, we know those things that like can get you there. And then it's up to them to take it the rest of the way.
I think that's a really interesting idea that we sort of got skipped. I like that a lot. Because we never got to have our time to use the information we were given.
Exactly.
We never got our time to sort of be like, and this is what our generation's about and what we're doing, and this is how we can pass it along to you. Because as we were being like establishing our identity as a generation, everything changed massively, monumentally, irrevocably. And now, as 30-somethings, yeah, as late 20s and 30-somethings, we're having to kind of go back to the drawing board and, like you said, relearn all this stuff, like going to, you know, having younger coworkers who just understand the way that social yeah media algorithms work.
Yeah.
And they know it, not because they've studied it, but just because that's
a part of
it. Just like a part of, you know, it's kind of like explaining a video game controller to a person one generation older than us. You know, they sit down and they're like, I don't get how any of this works. And yeah, it's sort of more intuitive to us. We're like, we were raised with these things in our hands. We generally know that like A and B generally are like jumping and punching,
yeah,
and
yeah,
things. It like, it goes back to like the very basics of the NES. Like, yeah, we're sort of raised with this tech in our hands. So we just understand it more intrinsically. And it, someone who doesn't know it, it's just, you know, it's like learning how to tap dance. It's like you have to learn how to walk all over, yeah, again. You might have had a long, illustrious dance career, and if you go to your first tap class, it's like a whole new language.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's so fascinating that we didn't really get our chance to like use the information we were given.
No. It
all just went away before we could. And so now, if we want to thrive in this current moment, we have to become students again, and we, yeah, have to become, which is doable. It's not, this all sounds a lot like, and I think that this is where millennials get a bad rap too, is it always sounds like we're making excuses for why we're not,
I know.
We're not thriving. You know, it always sounds like we're like, well, it wasn't fair. Like, 9/11 happened. And like, you know, and everyone's like, well, there's people your age who are still making millions of dollars. So what's your problem? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but it, I don't know. It's an interesting thing to examine the psychology of.
As a millennial, I instantly fight back. That's why I say this is what we have to offer, because at 35, I feel like I'm 65, and I feel like, mm-hmm, this ancient archaic thing. My fiance talks to me all the time. She's like, no, before you post anything on Instagram, just show it to me first, because it will be wrong. And she's right. It will be wrong. And I think that, yeah, okay, I don't exactly know that language as well as I could and should, so I do have to become a student to learn that. However, the language of Rocky movies, right?
Mm.
So love Michael B. Jordan, Creed. I mean, phenomenal movie.
It's not about how hard you can get hit. It's about many times you can get hit and keep getting back up.
But that's exactly it, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that was a terrible something.
It's pretty good, though. Jim Christian used to talk about kernels of truth, universal kernels of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, especially in our field in storytelling, that's the thing that we have intrinsically in our generation, these kernels of truth that, regardless of all the wrappings and trimmings around it, that kernel of truth is in all of us. It's the thing that makes you cry at the end of Pixar movies. It's the thing that makes you, you know, excited and celebrate, you know, when in The Matrix, you know, Neo wins, you know, like, it's those things that are in you.
God, that's a whole thing too. We came up with, I mean, everything was changing. Pixar movies. You mentioned that. It's like 1994, yeah, Toy Story. Like, the whole game was changing.
Yeah.
People had a certain style of movie for 40, 50 years, you know, color came along and then it kind of stayed the same for several decades.
Yeah.
And, I mean, literally, like, they were still doing claymation effects. They were going to do claymation dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. They were going to make them out of claymation, the same things that they did for the black and white King Kong versus, yeah, T-Rex movies in the 30s. Like, they were going to do that. And ILM showed Steven Spielberg just a test of, I think it was like some raptors running through a parking lot or something. And he was like, oh my God, you know,
yeah,
everything was changing. All the rules were being rewritten. And right now Gen Z is in a more settled place.
Yes.
They're in a more like, this is what it is until the next thing happens. AR is really interesting.
Yeah.
Augmented reality and VR is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They're very new. And I think that they haven't quite been the splash that everyone thought they would be. I think everyone thought when Oculus hits the market,
yeah,
it's all over.
Yeah.
It's taking more time than I even thought it would. I thought this is going to I mean, you've tried it before.
I have, yeah.
It's
insane.
It's insane. Yeah. It's so crazy how easy it is to trick your brain into being like, oh, I'm here.
Yeah.
I know I'm wearing this headset, but I'm here.
Yeah, like, it's scary, actually.
If I look over there and that's what it is, and I look over there and that's what it is, and I look over there and there's a zombie, then that's what's going on.
There's a zombie, yep.
And I'm here, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. But it's also crazy that it hasn't kind of taken off. There's been all these things like Google Glass and all these things that I thought would ramp up the augmented human experience faster.
Yeah.
But we have sort of settled with like tablets and smart devices and movies. It's not a movie unless it's loaded with CGI. And animated movies are solely computer animated, and we just keep getting better and better at that, to the point where it's like, is this even animation? Because it's so photorealistic.
Yeah, I know.
That like is the Lion King remake a live action movie? The whole thing is animated, but it's photorealistic animation.
Yeah.
So it's this weird, you know, I don't know how that affects us, but it's definitely still at this place where we don't really have a clear cut identity as a generation because of that hinge.
Yes.
Our identity is the hinge. Our identity is we're children of both worlds, you know?
Yeah.
We grew up with VHS tapes and.
Right. But that's kind of my point, mm-hmm. is that I think that I think that they are losing. So for example, on Netflix, on Disney Plus, not Disney Plus, I can't say that. There's a lot of content right now. There's shows all over the place. There's new shows all the time that you can watch.
It's exponential.
There's so much.
There was a time when there was like four channels.
Right.
And then there was 30 and everyone went, holy shit. Then there was 100 and everyone went, oh my God, how are you ever going to watch this much TV?
Exactly.
There's thousands.
There's
thousands of programs you can choose to watch.
On any given day, there's anything you can find, you can watch it.
In any given genre, is a plethora of,
But this is my point, that as much as I watch, I always seem to feel like I'm looking for that one. I'm looking for that show. It's like, this is going to be my show. I'm looking for that. And I think that what's happening is all these people can put out content, so they are, but they are also looking towards the millennials going, what are you going to watch? Are you watching this? Are you watching this? What if we throw this in? Are you watching this? And they're like, okay. But what we're waiting for, right, is that thing. Is that...
It's like when, you remember when Netflix debuted House of Cards, and there was a big story about how what they did was, they did this algorithm and they looked at what resonated with millennials, and there were all these things, like Bike Club and like things that we liked. And so they were like, okay, David Fincher, check.
Yeah.
We really liked Kevin Spacey at the time. We all really liked Kevin Spacey. Yeah. So there were all these things, but people were like, yeah, they ran this algorithm and it was like this, check, this, check, this, check. Like even down to the DP and down to like, and it worked. Like everyone was like, this is a great show.
It's great.
This is an awesome show. But that's getting harder and harder to predict because media is getting more and more personalized and individualized. Yep. And YouTube has a lot to do with that. I think everything is, you can cater your stuff specifically to you. And that's really, again, that's a shift that we were not prepared for.
Right.
We were raised as people in show business, especially raised to learn kind of marketing and like, and writing and everything based on what is going to be appealing to the largest amount of people. Now that's almost impossible. Now you almost just have to go, what's going to be appealing to your specific niche audience, you know? And then it's all becoming about like, be the most honest to yourself, and because that's going to speak to your niche audience, and you're going to find your group of 100,000 people who resonate with your stuff. And that's going to be your little piece of the pie. And it's a whole different game that we weren't prepared, you know?
But that's the thing that I'm trying to say to you is that we are kind of prepared for it because, as Smash Mouth said, you know, when all that glitters is gold, only shooting stars break the mold.
God.
What I'm saying is that those universal kernels of truth will always be. We have Disney Plus, and Sarah and I were watching we just started watching Cinderella again, and the music started in the beginning, and both of us instantly started crying.
Really? The cartoon?
Instantly, yeah. It's 1950. Why? Why? Because we both remember a time. I remember a time where I was a little black kid sitting in daycare with all these other little white kids on a couch eating cereal, eating Cheerios that the home teacher had given us, and they put on Cinderella, and the comfort I felt, like I was at home watching this cartoon, you know, and I felt safe. And it came back to me, you know, just this feeling of, oh my God. And Cinderella is like one of these classic stories. I mean, Disney did a really well job of being like, these are the morals. We're feeding you your morals. You know, don't be a douchebag like the fairy god or the mother who keeps her kid locked up, you know.
Yeah.
Be the person who is real and honest and nice and kind. Like that, those little kernels of truth still will always bleed through. So what we can offer, I believe, is that, are those little stepping stones, you know?
That's probably what makes us such a nostalgic generation. Everyone always talks about how, I mean, it's a big thing for our generation. Nostalgia is a big thing. Doing callbacks and doing, you know, all these remakes and all these reboots and stuff. And the often the problem with the reboots is that they don't go nostalgic enough. It's too different. It's too new. And like, we want it like, no, like everyone's favorite things in the new Star Wars movies is when they have practical effects, when there's just like a character that has makeup on.
Yeah.
It's really, or like a big Jim Henson puppet. And we're like, that's that shit. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. That's that real shit.
Yeah.
Their mouth moves all weird. And like, that's, that's it. Like, you know, I want it to be something I could touch. Like, you know, even though in many ways, digital animation, those characters can be more expressive and more, you know, and they can move in more interesting ways. What I was going to ask is, do you think it's getting harder to sell these kind of morals, these simple, clear-cut stories to kids because we're a more skeptical generation because of the information? Like you talked about with 9/11 and all this stuff happening, our sort of apathy and indifference toward voting and toward power systems and things like that and power structures and our responsibility to participate in them, you know, our how we don't really care because we're just sort of trying to find our own way and we're very distrusting. Do you think it's harder to sell us and Gen Z on simple morals and simple, like, clear-cut stories?
I think the proof will be in the pudding, in the sense that whether you sell them or not, it has to be there. So what am I trying to say? Sorry, I use metaphors in movies. That's how I grew up. But
I'm all about it.
You know, in The Matrix, Commander Locke says to Morpheus, he's like, not everyone believes in what you believe. And Morpheus said, my beliefs do not require them to. It's this notion that Because the battle can be won. The mountain can be climbed. We all know that. History has proven time and time again that, especially as Americans, that's what we pride ourselves on, winning the fight, right?
Yeah.
So in this specific time of all of us being so skeptical, mm-hmm. the millennials are going to do it or they're not. I think what's going to cripple us is the separation, the depression, the bipolarism, all the things that we're going through, and the doubt, and that feeling of being like, of looking to someone and being like, can this actually work? And no one having any answers. Just having the belief and being like, yeah, it is. If you keep trying and if you do the right things, it will work. Just having that, I feel like, will at least have shifted in a direction where it can work.
See, and the more information we get and the more we move into this generation, the more it feels like, for me, like I'm losing the hope that it can. And even, you know, I was pretty jaded on the electoral system and on voting and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I got really into 9/11 truth stuff when I was a teenager. And sure. I remember when Loose Change hit YouTube and it was like the craziest thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was like someone was just, you know, showing me the code of the Matrix.
Yeah.
And I was all of a sudden like, oh, of course. And again, I'm not saying that I think it was a government conspiracy, but what that did for me is it opened up my mind to like, Oh, duh. Of course governments do that. The history of the world is people usurping thrones and like coups. And, you know, Shakespeare wrote about this. And this is what humans do. We plot and we scheme and we have secret plans. And and there, especially when it's when there's so much on the line, when there's massive stakes. And that's not stuff, that's not business that can always be readily transparent.
Right.
And I saw it on Joe Rogan. They were talking about Jeffrey Epstein the other day, and they were like, if there's anything good that came out of this, it's that a whole bunch of people, because the Epstein thing was so outrageous, a whole bunch of new people went, well, geez, maybe there is something to some of these other conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Because like it's just so obvious that that guy, or like that the story we're being told is just a bunch of bullshit. Like, it just like, wait, what? They were asleep? What is it? What was it? A cartoon sheriff from like a Looney Tunes cartoon? Was he like kicking back in his chair with like the ring of keys around his hip, and he was just kind of going, shoo, shoo. And like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
And they were asleep. Like, and the videos, the cameras were off, and his cellmate wasn't in the cell with him, and he had time to fashion a rope out of his sheets and hang him. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, it's so clearly bullshit that it might have opened up people's eyes to like, yes, there are very powerful people who had a vested interest in having this man not go to court and testify. And it makes sense that someone had access and power enough to get into this high security situation and kill this guy.
Absolutely.
And once you allow room for that, you go, oh, well, maybe that happens
more than you think.
More than you would think.
Yeah.
And that's, anyway, I already had that idea growing up. And so I was already pretty jaded. And then this 2016 election happens. And I remember him coming down that gold escalator to announce that he was going to be president. And I remember thinking, oh shit, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And I was like laughing at it. I was like, so absurd. It can't. But the whole way, as every step happened, as he won the primary and as he did all that stuff, I was like, never had it been more clear to me that I have to vote, even if I don't believe in the system. Like, I have to do something. Even if it's something that's not going to stop this inevitable thing from happening, I have to go out and vote. And then when he won, it just was, I remember I was like watching the election results from my apartment in Brooklyn at like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And I was laughing on my couch because I just was, I couldn't believe what I was watching. But also I was like, of course, like, of course it didn't matter that like this was so clear that we weren't going to be able to help ourselves, or, and fuck, if there was some meddling with Russia or whatever happened, it just seemed like Donald Trump was inevitable.
It was,
you know?
Well, and this is leads into the other thing you were saying, Austin, is that, you know, when he was even nominated to be the Republican person who was going to be president, I told people, and they laughed at me. I told them, I was like, he's going to win. And they're like, there's no way he's going to win. I'm like, no, he's going to win. And my reasoning has always been, because America has always, since the beginning of America, has always treated the symptom and not the problem. Now, treating the problem is very, very hard to do. So you treat symptoms so you can continue to go day to day.
Well, and even that shit was always a part of me not believing in the political system, where it's just like, we just change horses every 8 years.
Yeah.
We're like, ah, it's not perfect. Change
something else.
Switch teams. You know, like, it's not perfect again. Switch teams.
Yeah.
Like, so even if everything's above board and everyone's votes really do count and there is no meddling and everything really does work the way it's supposed to work, I still don't like it.
Yeah.
I still am like, so we just change sides every 8 years and in perpetuity forever. And we have two options every time.
Right.
And that's what we do. It all. And I don't think I think this is a thing about our culture, or about our generation, I should say, that we kind of look at the whole mechanism. And Gen Z's totally on this train. Gen Z's like, yeah, no, guys, it's all so stupid.
Yeah.
And I saw a meme once that was like millennials, and it was like an emo kid being like, what's the point? Who cares? Nothing matters. And then it was like Gen Z, and it was like some kid wearing like a dog collar with like green hair. And he was like, what's the point? Who cares? Nothing matters. You know, and he was like, they're a little bit more like, all good, Gucci, I'm going to create my YouTube channel and go do my shit, like, in, you know,
right.
I don't know.
But I think this is the point, is that as the system breaks down, because it is breaking down, because it's old and the gears are rusted and they don't work anymore. This is the time to seize the day. this is why I bring up the heroes and the stories that we've been taught, because there was a time where people in England were like, screw this. I don't know if it's going to be right or how it's going to work, but I can't stand this anymore. So we got to figure something else out. And it was very unpopular and it was very weird and everyone thought it was going to fail, but they left and they came to America and they said, let's figure it out. Right? So it is now the time for the greatest decisions to be made, for this decision, this hinge generation, to become the generation that saves us all. It has to. And I think that there's...
Do we do it by mass murder and imperialism? And
we can't do that. I think we've learned better. Hopefully we've learned better than that. But it's time to know that we have the power to make that decision and to figure it out, and that we need to. Because you've already got executives looking to us for answers. What do you guys want? We're the people that they're selling to. We don't realize that if we stop going to McDonald's, if everyone in Los Angeles stopped going to McDonald's for a day, they'd be like, what's going on? You know what I mean? We have the power, right? We have the power.
Yeah, we've become so jaded.
Exactly.
And so, it's just so hard to believe in that. It's so hard to, believe. I want to. See, it's my side before the hinge, the side that I was raised on, before the big technology boom, before the information, before 9/11, that side of me wants to believe you. The side of me that saw The Matrix when I was 11 years old and saw that once you see through the charade of things, you become more powerful than you ever could imagine, and you become able to change the system to the way you see fit. And you can, when the time comes, Neo, you won't have to.
Yeah.
You won't have to dodge them, because you'll be able to stop them, dude.
Yeah.
That shit was so, that blew my mind as an 11-year-old kid.
Absolutely.
In the theater. And the part of me afterward, the part of me that became this jaded, skeptical, cynical adult is like, I don't know, man. It's all so much more powerful than me, you know? If my only option is to show up to the polling station on November 6th and vote for one of the two parties, it just doesn't seem like doing the same thing. You know,
you just need a hero, man.
I mean,
do you see what I'm saying? But you are. That's what I'm saying. It's like you're looking at him. You're the hero.
Sometimes I hear politicians speak that make me feel like that's the person.
Yeah.
And then almost anytime I think I found that person, everyone else is like, no, not that person. And I'm like, but I like it, that person. And, you know,
it's difficult. I'm sorry, not to interrupt you, but. Neo was nothing without Trinity, and Trinity couldn't have done anything without Morpheus, and that ship couldn't have flown without the people who Link.
Without that backstabbing Cypher.
Nebuchadnezzar, and the whole city of Zion, who was hoping, their hopes hinged on one person doing this. So you have an entire city, a civilization of people back hoping this one person can, Jesus Christ, can sacrifice themselves for them, right? You see it happen all the time. How many followers can you get? If you had 500 million followers right now and said, hey guys, we're now doing this to shift the power of America, guess what would happen? It would shift. That's the That's the scary thing.
You can swear on this show.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And it's scary because it's true. These young generation Z, Y, whatever kids don't realize that they hold all of the cards. And they're like you. They're like, but what do we have? And I'm like, yeah, you literally control finance, the stock market. You control everything. Everyone's trying to figure out how to sell everything to you. You have a president who's tweeting.
Yeah.
So
it's like his number one correspondence.
You know what I mean? So all we have to do as the generation, right, the hinge on that hinge who realizes that, is somehow inform them like, hey guys, ball's in your court. All you got to do is shoot.
Is The Matrix our Star Wars?
Absolutely. You ask me, you bet.
I mean, it feels like it to me. Like, it feels like such a cultural moment for people who were kids when we were kids.
And yeah.
For, you know, for like, you know. it felt like such a massive thing. You mentioned something earlier that I thought was really interesting, where you kind of said, and I think it has something to do with our attention spans getting shorter and all that stuff. Of course, you know, just the amount of media that there is. We talked about TV channels going from 3 to 100 to infinity over the last 50 years. And really, like, the infinity thing happened in the last like 15, 20 years. But so it's kind of shortened our attention span and our ability to have lasting things. You talked about this, that we don't really have lasting things, and we don't know how to have these lasting things. We're remaking Star Wars right now because Star Wars was a lasting, it was an institution that really kind of rocked pop culture in this way where, like, people didn't get over it, that we're not over it. We're still not over it. And I mean, the MCU is amazing. I think what Kevin Feige and Marvel did over 20 years is really, really impressive with their, those movies. But
you need a new narrative.
But don't you feel like we're going to be over it in like 2 years?
Already over it.
Aren't we already over it?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, we just blow. Like, everyone saw Endgame and it was like, holy shit, that was so great. Amazing. And like, that happened this year.
Yeah.
And it feels like it happened. I just am like, oh yeah, Endgame. I remember seeing that in the theater. It's like, what, 6 months ago?
Yeah.
Like, it just happened. And it's not, its effect was over a week after, you know, I mean, I still talk about it. I think it's a
really, well, we do.
But yeah, I think, what do you think about that? That we, how can we have these heroes and these, a re-implementation of these ideals of our power? If we can't have things that last more than a few days, you know, I mean, we talked about like our political movements are so big while they're happening and they're immediately over when they're over. Occupy was the thing. It was
100%.
And
everyone cared so deeply and so much for a second.
I bet when I just said Occupy, people listening were like, what's that? And then and then they had to be like, oh, right. Occupy Wall Street. Right. Like, you know, it's like the civil rights movement. You say that, everyone knows what you're talking about. It's like, that was the thing. Like, you know, we don't really even have like a name for like the war we were in for 14 years.
Yeah, I know. You're right.
Vietnam War, World War II, World War I, Korean War, Gulf War, the, you know, like, and then we get to this war. It's like the
war on
the George Bush, the 9/11 war, the Muslim thing. Like, we, like, you know, it just kind of like, we kind of were bored with the war before it was even over.
Yeah.
We're still like, in some ways, still engaged in that conflict. And we're sort of like, I don't know. Like, we're sort of like past thinking about it. And
well, because I think that you have to, you either you're eating steak or you're eating like cheeseburgers. Right. I mean, I think Martin Luther King is a superhero.
Yeah.
And I think definitely. That he's a superhero because not only did he have a successful march in Montgomery, but he kept having successful marches. And in the face of being told he was going to be killed, he kept talking and he kept opening his mouth and he kept doing it. He kept doing it. He kept doing it. So he never dies. His message is the kernel of truth that never dies. Everyone deserves those rights and not violently. We're not getting them violently because we respect the fact that everyone's people. We're all people.
And we all now agree. Too.
Yes.
Everyone at the time we were more divided, but in the curve of history, we all agree on the message.
Exactly.
But what happens if we all, if our people right now are here and we're missing them because of the oversaturation? You know what I mean? Like, like there's so many. But this goes back to what I was talking about, where I'm like, I have political people that will stand up and say things. You can judge me. I don't give a shit. I like Bernie Sanders. Yeah, every time the guy talks, I'm like, that's it, you guys.
Yeah.
Like, everyone always, they love to paint Bernie as like this insane idealist who's talking about free. Everything's going to be free. Like, nothing costs money and everything's free. And I'm just like, that's such an oversimplification and such a reductive view of what he's talking about.
Yes.
He's talking about the fact that the richest corporations in the world aren't paying taxes and we should be getting their fucking money to help us pay for the things that we can't afford.
Right.
And it's like, that seems so obvious and clear
and doable and practical and fair.
Yeah.
And the fact that he can kind of be, just be dismissed as like an old kook, you know, and that so many people like him can emerge and can have their fan bases and have people who are like, no, this is the person, you guys, but we just can't get behind them because we can't sit down and focus long enough to actually, because a lot of people I think who hate these people or who don't like them haven't even spent the time getting to know what they're about.
Of course they haven't.
There's way too many people to follow to actually spend the time. And I'm like, I bet there's many, I know so many people who like Andrew Yang and they're like, I love him. I love, is that his name? Andrew Yang? I'm pretty sure that's the guy that's, oh my God, if I'm wrong, I'm going to feel really bad. I just say some Asian sounding name. But like, I've heard him on a couple interviews and I was like, he sounds like a smart guy. I don't know nearly enough to have an educated opinion. I bet if I did more research, I'd be like, oh, this guy's really smart.
Yeah.
There's just so many. And so again, we're a generation asking for more options than two. I don't want just the two-party system, but then we get all these people who are stepping up within the two-party system, admittedly. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for us to even pay attention to any one of them long enough for any of them to become Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
They can't have their time to let the message sink in and to let us all get on board with it. There's too – we have too many heroes.
That's true. I also feel like what do you – I mean, I guess the stakes were different in Martin Luther King's time. And it was a different, you know, okay. But at the same time, like, he was also a minister. So he was in the community. And he drug those community people with him. He went to other communities. He spent most of his time talking to people in the communities. So if they really want people's votes, they need to go to, they need to find the top 10 influencers.
Oh, but aren't they doing
that? And go talk to them.
Isn't that what they do, though? Like, it's all about, like, getting on the right podcast.
Yeah,
or getting interviewed. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's like,
you just have to, I think they, I don't, I'm not an advocate of any of them because I don't know who they are and maybe I should, I don't know. But I feel like I was talking about those top influencers. Why do they care? So they need to know, they need to let them know, hey, listen, this is what's happening to you. In the next, when you're not 15 or 16 anymore, in the next so-and-so many years, these luxuries that you have now are all going to be taken away. And this is why. And you need to vote on this, you know, like they need to find a way to get to them somehow.
Maybe that's how Donald Trump won, is we didn't really need to like do a deep dive on what's this guy about. He was already someone we knew. He's been on TV. Like, we know what he's about. He's a hard-nosed businessman who doesn't take any bullshit from anyone.
Yep.
And who isn't afraid to make like tough negotiations and tell people that they're out if they're not doing their job right. You know, and it's just
exposure.
Kinda like, we already had, like, it's like, yeah, you know who Donald Trump is.
Of course.
He's a famous billionaire. Like, yeah. He's a famously successful person.
Yeah.
You know, and as much as we tried to defame him with like, he's not that great of a businessman. He's not that good with money. He's a notorious piece of shit and womanizer.
Yeah.
People, maybe that's the thing, is they just were like, yeah, but he's not someone, but I know him.
Yep.
You know, I don't need to, like, I know him, you know? And how can you compete with that?
Well, I mean, if there was a reality TV show, Hillary's whole life, just following her around,
mm-hmm.
showing all the things she's done for America.
And all the people that the Clintons have murdered.
But I mean, like, you know, you're talking about like information, yeah. like at the time, like I feel like you have to have your whole thing on display for everyone to see, and then people have to be watching it. And if they're watching it, even if they see it a few seconds, it's like, oh, I know that. I know. I understand. I'm gonna make them.
Well, but that's why she was the best person to run against him, is because even people who are like, no, Bernie would have won. I'm like, but the reason I think why the DNC was so dead set on her is she was the closest thing to a household name that they had.
Yeah.
To run against another household name.
Yep.
You know, it's like it's like, you know who Hillary Rodham Clinton is.
Yeah.
Like she's the wife of Bill Clinton. Like,
yeah.
You know, she's been around. You know about her. She was Obama's Secretary of State. Like,
yeah.
Like, we know who this person is. And the rest of the people, it's like, yeah, you might have a better message. You might, like, have a more ravenous fan base. But if we're going to compete with this mega celebrity, we've got to have a celebrity of our own. And she's the closest thing we've got right now, you know? And I don't know. I'm totally speculating here, but
they were going to lose anyway.
Yeah, it all just seems. They were gonna lose anyway. But again, here we go back with the apathy of like, what am I supposed to do? We have as much as I love the MCU, going back to like, we have too many heroes. You know, when we grew up, it was, who's your favorite superhero? Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're like an X-Men person.
Wolverine. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But like, I remember when the Iron Man movie came out and I was like, Iron Man? Who gives a shit about Iron Man? Me, yeah. Apparently. Because yeah. Now yeah. He's my dude. You know, yeah. When he died, I was sobbing. Again, if you haven't seen the movie, what the hell's wrong with you? Yeah. But I was sobbing in yeah. the theater. Like, yeah. I didn't care about Iron Man 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, now I have a whole world of superheroes that I care about, but also that contributes, again, to superhero fatigue. There's a big contingent of the population who's like, I just don't give a shit. Yeah. I don't care. It's hard to get me to care about, like, oh, this story of what's Spider-Man going to do when he's on vacation with his friends. I don't, yeah, I don't exactly. care. Like,
but you mentioned things like V for Vendetta.
Yeah. Great movie. Love it.
Great movie.
That movie inspired me when I saw it. I thought, 100%. Oh my God, like we need to take the power back. Is that possible though in the current climate? Can we do that?
I think
you seem so optimistic.
I think because the other option is death, right? I mean,
strolling apathetically.
The other option is doom. I mean,
rocking and rolling to the end of the world.
Too many times.
Climate change, here we come, baby.
We are, and we've almost accepted the fact that, oh, well, it's going to end and we're all going down. And I just feel like there are, the world hangs, it's like a movie. The world hangs on the balance, on this thin thread. And it's only held up by a couple of people who are like, but it can work. But it can. And it's like, well, how? And I think that conversations like this, right? I think that, you know, finding a way to rally ourselves in this generation to be like, okay, let's just fix things really quick and then we can go back to partying, right? Because that's all we really want to do is just hang out with our friends and have a good time and do some work and whatever. Like, do what we want to do. But everything is so broken, it needs to be fixed. And so if we can just focus on doing that, I do think that the smartest minds in the world right now can do it. It was a couple of years ago now, but there's this kid who thought of a way to literally suck in all the plastics out of the ocean.
Yeah.
Remember that story?
Yeah. We've got these like these super kids that come out and it's always really inspiring. Again, it's a flash in the pan thing. We've got this Greta Thunberg right now that like goes before the UN and she gives that impassioned speech and it's amazing. And everyone's talking about Greta Thunberg right now. She's on late night shows and everyone's talking about her. In a year, no one will be talking about Greta Thunberg.
Exactly.
And I don't know. I remember that kid. I remember that thing. And I remember every time these things happen, I go, oh, here we go. Here we go.
But that's the thing. People are making money off of them. You're going on shows because they're being like, oh, look, it's going to up my ratings.
Mm-hmm.
Where those people should be in positions of power making decisions. No way are they going to let them do that.
Yeah.
I'll use you to sell my product or to get more viewers or whatever. But to actually implement what you're talking about, not doing that.
Yeah.
And that's because the generation before us is like holding on to everything and bleeding everything for every last ounce of money until everything dies. That's the problem. That's the thing we need to be fighting against. You know?
They are still clinging. And again, this is so broad and so general.
I know.
But in many ways, you know, while we're trying to adjust to the hinge, we're trying to, you know, like we didn't really get our time in the sun. Like I remember the year 2000 coming and it was like the coolest sounding thing in the world. You remember that? Like,
the millennium.
New Year, the millennium. Yeah. Dude.
Huge.
Millennium. Yeah. You know, like songs like Prince had a song.
Yeah.
Like,
Will Smith.
What was Will Smith's millennium song?
Here it comes another year.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Dude, that was such a funny trend when everyone was like singing about like, cause it felt like the future was coming. Like
yeah.
Nothing sounded cooler than the year 2000.
Yeah.
I remember like when I was a kid talking with my friends about how we were going to have hoverboards in the year 2000. And we yeah. were gonna, like, I thought the year 2000 was so far away. It was like 5 years away. But Yeah, adjusting to that hinge. So we're kind of like dancing through the 90s, being Gen X. And I feel like there's also a thing where our generation does this too. We cling to, we sort of want to be Gen X instead of millennials. Like we want to be like, well, I like Kurt Cobain and I like, I like the 90s music and I was raised with the 90s music and, you know, like, and I remember Big Willie Style.
Yeah.
And I like, you know, like I was there for that because we didn't get our moment to have our thing because our thing was the hinge.
Yes.
The year 2000 happened and the future did come. It didn't look anything like we thought it would.
Yeah.
Right away, 2001, 9/11, you know, you've got school shootings on TV every other day. You've got all this stuff. It looked nothing. It was the information age and it wasn't as cool as we thought it would be. And we were in the process of adjusting to it. I think what is happening is, this older generation, the richest people in the world right now are still clinging to not even our way of doing things, but like three generations back way of doing things. And there are people who seem to be motivated to move that forward. It does seem at times like Elon Musk is a billionaire who's interested in like moving things forward. But then it also just seems like he's just another fucking like greedy billionaire who's just kind of like, I don't know. It's so hard to people get so weird when they have that much money because you look at them too and you just go, it seems like you really could save the world and you're not doing it.
Yeah.
The cool thing about Tony Stark and Bruce Wayne is that they actually put all of their wealth into literally saving the world.
And
it really seems like you look at people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, and it seems like they're all in a competition with each other to be richer than each other.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're all like, oh, but did you know that they do hundreds of millions of dollars a year in charity? And it's like, that's nothing to them. Yeah. Yeah. They could, with their wealth, they could combine their forces and literally
end stuff.
And end stuff. They could literally be like, we're going to buy out the oil industry and we are going to create the new infrastructure for underground transportation so that we don't have above ground cars. And like, they could pay for it.
Yeah.
They could save the world. They could deplete their wealth collectively and put it all into saving the world, and they won't. And every day that they don't, it makes me go, people, you can't change human nature. Like you won't actually have a Tony Stark or a Bruce Wayne who wants to build a shield around the world and who really wants to put all their wealth into.
It depends on the narrative. It depends on if our heroes are those people who are the villains, or not villains, but those people who care more about money than people, or if the narrative is on those people who care about people more. It's the narrative. It's always been storytelling.
But what can the people who care about people do? Because if you don't have, you know,
Martin Luther King didn't have money.
Yeah, but he had the following.
He got the following.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
But how do we do that in an age that's so saturated? I keep undercutting like all of your hopefulness.
I understand, but
you
think about, name any famous influencer, if they just decided to take up a cause, you know, with their who knows how many millions of followers and just kept on it. But even, I really believe that
I feel like some of them do. And I feel like because it's so personalized and everyone has their own little niche audience, even like a Bernie, it's like you saw the groundswell that happened. Support for that guy where he'd go and speak and 50,000 people would come out to listen. And you'd see the video footage of it. It's like, whoa, this guy's really doing something. And in a world of 8 billion people, everyone having their 1 million, 2 million subscribers, 3 million subscribers, it's a drop in the bucket. Everyone gets their own little, and no one has enough support to.
I don't necessarily agree with that because I could totally be wrong. Please correct me. Wasn't it that the people voted Bernie? Like they wanted Bernie, but like something happened?
Well, the DNC, I don't know enough about the details of this to speak intelligently on it, but there was something about the DNC rigging their.
So the system is broken.
Rigging for Hillary. They wanted Hillary and they did, you know, Bernie did have, there was a lot of numbers that suggested that in a head-to-head election with Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders would have had the support to win.
Yeah.
And that's why Bernie stans get so mad about the fact that Hillary was the nominee because they're like, we would have won.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? You never can know what that would have actually looked like. But yeah, it adds to the apathy. It adds to the skepticism. It adds to the frustration.
I think that's where I'm going is that, you know, in a game that's rigged, you will never win. So you can't play the game anymore.
So we have to break the game somehow.
We have to create a better game. And that's what the Americans did.
When they came over.
They created a better game. We just have to create a better game. And I say just.
Is there a way to do that that's not so messy? That's not so ugly and so violent and so...
I don't know.
Yeah. I hate to keep undercutting all of your hope, but it's like, I want to be there with you. And I think that this is so indicative of our generation that we are, it's really hard for us to believe in anything outside of ourselves. At least for me, it's like at the end of the day, all I can come back to is like, well, I'll try my best, you know?
Yeah.
I'll try to keep.
And I think that's
following things that inspire me and trying to support things that seem true and relevant to me. But that age of humans can do anything, and we will. We can overcome anything. We've been to the moon. I agree with you that the smartest minds in the world can fix climate change or can find a way for us to live sustainably on this planet. I don't know if we can reverse what's already been done, the damage that's been done.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that like we are a resilient and smart enough species that we should be able to do it. It's the personalization of media and the dispersing of information that makes me go, it's too divided and spread across the board to get the species unified. You'd think that the information era has a unifying effect where it
doesn't.
But what it almost does is the unifying effect is it creates skeptics of everyone. Everyone is skeptical of the media, as they should be. Everyone's skeptical of the government. Everyone's skeptical of each other. Everyone's skeptical of everyone else's hero. Every time someone says, this is my person, you should get behind my person. Everyone else is like, I don't know, I have my person. And my person says your person is, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we can stem that tide. Maybe we have to figure out how to... Yeah, you might be right. Just make it work in a new way.
I think you have to make it. I think you have to do things like this. I think you have to make it popular for one.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that you have to get exposure.
Yeah.
You have to be the star that shines bright enough for everyone to see and listen for as long as you can.
Well, I've got a couple hundred weekly listeners, so we're well on the way here with this conversation. But doesn't that sound like the old way of doing things? Getting exposure, building a brand, like making sure you know,
it's interesting. Yes. I think that, yeah. And I think that these are the things that I bring to the table.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm, you know,
I hope you don't feel like I'm like,
no, but it's good.
Constantly swatting down.
I feel like this is the metaphor I'm going to give you. I feel like I'm, Obi-Wan Kenobi now. So now he's like 140. You know, he's just like, and there's this young kid, you know, texting on the phone. And then
I gotta go get some power converters.
It's like, hey, you know, if you just calm yourself for a second and listen to the earth, like you can use the force, you know, like, and they're like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but we just have to be that. Because if there is no Ben Kenobi, there is no new hope. Right?
Yeah.
So I don't have the answers, right? I don't have the answers. All I know is that I'm on this generation, on this hinge where in my career, in my life, in my relationships, the only reason that I've actually survived with any of the things and talents I have is because before I stepped on stage, I was like, no, you can do it. You can do it. Any and every single time I doubted that, I failed horribly. And I've failed so many times. But the only way I've been able to overcome is to have some kind of faith, man.
Yeah.
And I think that once I keep my faith and continue on and continually perpetuate that, hopefully it catches on.
Yeah, faith is kind of the only way I'm doing anything right now. And I have a different relationship with the word than I used to. But it's kind of the only way I can operate is faith that the truth will out and will prevail.
Here's the thing. Remember. Okay, you know Steph Curry.
Mm-hmm.
The Steph Curry.
Yeah. I've heard of him.
I was watching a game. I don't watch basketball. I just don't. And it just happened to be on. And I saw this man take an inbound pass and shoot the ball and make it. Now, people who know Steph Curry, they've seen him do this numerous times. A guy mm-hmm. can shoot from anywhere, but I'd never seen it before.
Yeah.
And I saw that happen and I was like, what? That's possible.
Yeah.
A human can shoot from there and make it look like
a regular easy. Jump shot. But he's 50 feet back.
So it's that little victory, that small little victory that makes you go, well, maybe I can do that.
Yeah. And when you're watching Steph Curry play and watching, I mean, so there are basketball players. The reason I love watching basketball and sports in general, but basketball, you really see this kind of like individual belief, this like belief in the self. And when you're watching Steph Curry do that, it really feels like you're watching a guy who is so like he's hacking the system.
Yeah.
He believes in himself so much that he has the confidence to shoot and turn around and look at the opposing bench as he runs down the court before the ball's gone in and hold up three fingers. And like, yeah. Can you imagine if he missed like half the time that he did that? He shoots and he turns around and does this and it just bricks. Clank. But it's like he makes it and he yeah. knows that he's made it when he releases the ball and he turns around and looks at the bench before the ball's dropped, you know, and like starts running down the court. People hate that about him. But what you're seeing is this like next level of confidence. And you see that with players like Michael Jordan and stuff like
yeah.
that. But this kind of, how are you doing that? And I think that I can get on board with that, that people have to start having faith in themselves and then faith in each other. And yeah, we have to somehow break this cycle of skepticism.
You have to believe that it yeah. can be broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to believe that there is a great hero. There is a great Iron Man who's going to come and fix and save everything. And the scary thing about that is that it's you. So you have to put on your armor and fail and think about some things, but it's time to go to work.
You think millennials are going to be okay?
Yep.
Oh,
I do think so, and I hope that we can. I have great hope.
Okay,
yeah.
I have to pee. You feel all right?
I feel good.
All right. I think we could talk about this for a long time.
Yeah.
I think we did a good job.
Austin, thank you so much for having me. I very much appreciate it. It was really fun.
You're the best, and I'm so glad you were here because you're becoming one of my oldest friends. The older and older we get. And it's always a pleasure.
Okay. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks.
No problem.
Carlton Bluford. Isn't he the best? He's the best. And that laugh, dude, that laugh. I wish I had a cool laugh. I'm really envious of people with really good laughs. I have a coworker who has this really like booming laugh, and I haven't told him yet. I'm going to tell him the next time he laughs. I'm going to say, you have an amazing laugh. My partner, Mary, has a great laugh. Just jealous of people with good laughs. Carlton's got such an epic laugh. Whenever Carlton comes and sees a show that you're in, you know he's in the audience because you can hear that distinctive laugh. Yeah, I said at the beginning that we probably weren't going to answer any of the questions I posited in the intro, and I don't think we did. I also said that I wasn't going to be able to douse his positivity, and I don't think I did. Also, in that interview, I think I made fun of the American electoral system and how we just kind of change horses every 8 years when we panic about things not being instantly perfect. And it's funny, even though I made fun of that and I kind of stand by that, I personally think, you know, one of the only things I can imagine us being able to do about any of this is, you know, switching horses and changing teams in November this year. So, I mean, I think we should do that because I can't imagine it being any worse than the team and the horse we have right now. So I don't know. That's my two cents. That's all I've got. Thanks for listening this week. Tune in next week.
when my guest will be Jesse Pepe, another old friend from college, but also we went to high school together, so that should be interesting. People Pleaser is written, edited, produced, and hosted by me, Austin Archer, with original music also by me. And now, audio engineering by Marmalade Music. Check out Marmalade Music. Go to marmalademusicslc.com to hit them up for your audio project, for your podcast, or for your album, or for your single, or for whatever it is that you're recording at home that you want to sound tip-top. marmalademusicslc.com. Mention People Pleaser. Get 20% off. Check out Austin Archer, austin-archer.com for more of my stuff. What else? I think that's everything other than that I love you and, you know, rate and subscribe. Talk about the show on your Instagram story, Facebook story, whatever. Yeah. Okay. That's it. Bye.